Sloane mouthed the word Hellgrind.
You rescued me?
I did.
What about?
Leave your questions. Eat this first. His harsh tone acted like a whip on the butcher. Sloane cringed and reached with fumbling fingers for the lizard. Releasing it, Aragorn retreated to his place next to the rock oven and scooped handfuls of dirt onto the coals, blotting out the glow so that it would not betray their presence in the unlikely event that anyone else was in the vicinity. After an initial tentative lick to determine what it was Aragorn had given him, Sloane dug his teeth into the lizard and ripped a thick gobbet from the carcass. With each bite, he crammed as much flesh into his mouth as he could, and only chewed once or twice before swallowing and repeating the process. He stripped each bone clean with the efficiency of a man who possessed an intimate understanding of how animals were constructed and what was the quickest way to disassemble them. The bones he dropped into a neat pile on his left. As the final morsel of meat from the lizard's tail vanished down Sloane's gullet, Aragorn handed him the other reptile, which was yet whole. Sloane grunted in thanks and continued to gorge himself, making no attempt to wipe the fat from his mouth and chin. The second lizard proved to be too large for Sloane to finish. He stopped two ribs above the bottom of the chest cavity and placed what was left of the carcass on the cairn of bones. Then he straightened his back, drew his hand across his lips, tucked his long hair behind his ears, and said, "Thank you, strange sir, for your hospitality. It has been so long since I had a proper meal. I think I prize your food even above my own freedom. If I may ask, do you know of my daughter, Katrina, and what has happened to her? She was imprisoned with me in Hellgrind."
His voice contained a complex mixture of emotions. Respect, fear, and submission in the presence of an unknown authority. Hope and trepidation as to his daughter's fate, and determination as unyielding as the mountains of the spine. The one element Aragorn expected to hear but did not was the sneering disdain Sloane had used with him during their encounters in Carvajal.
"She is with Roran."
Sloane gaped.
"Roran? How did he get here? Did the Razak capture him as well? Or did—"
"The Razak and their steeds are dead."
"You killed them? How? Who—"
For an instant Sloane froze, as if he were stuttering with his entire body, and then his cheeks and mouth went slack, and his shoulders caved in, and he clutched at a bush to steady himself. He shook his head.
"No, no, no. No! It can't be! The Razak spoke of this. They demanded answers I didn't have, but I thought, that is, who would believe?"
His sides heaved with such violence Aragorn wondered if he would hurt himself. In a gasping whisper, as if he were forced to speak after being punched in the middle, Sloane said,
"You can't be Aragorn?"
A sense of doom and destiny descended upon Aragorn. He felt as if he were the instrument of those two merciless overlords, and he replied in accordance, slowing his speech so each word struck like a hammer blow and carried all the weight of his dignity, station, and anger.
"I am Aragorn, and far more. I am Arjatlam, and Shadeslayer, and Firesword. My dragon is Saphira, she who is also known as Beartskula and Flametongue. We were taught by Brom, who was a rider before us, and by the dwarves and by the elves. We have fought the Urgals and Ashade and Murtagh, who is Morzan's son. We serve the Varden and the peoples of Alagasia, and I have brought you here, Sloane Aldenson, to pass judgment upon you for murdering Bird and for betraying Carvajal to the Empire."
"You lie! You cannot be—"
"Lie!" roared Aragorn. "I do not lie!"
Thrusting out with his mind, he engulfed Sloane's consciousness in his own and forced the butcher to accept memories that confirmed the truth of his statements. He also wanted Sloane to feel the power that was now his, and to realize that he was no longer entirely human. And while Eragon was reluctant to admit it, he enjoyed having control over a man who had often made trouble for him, and also tormented him with jibes, insulting both him and his family. He withdrew a half minute later. Sloane continued to quiver, but he did not collapse and grovel as Eragon thought he might. Instead, the butcher's demeanor became cold and flinty.
"Blast you," he said. "I don't have to explain myself to you, Eragon, son of none. Understand this, though. I did what I did for Katrina's sake and nothing else."
"I know. That's the only reason you're still alive."
"Do what you want with me, then. I don't care, so long as she's safe." "Well, go on. What's it to be, a beating, a branding? They already had my eyes, so one of my hands? Or will you leave me to starve, or to be recaptured by the Empire?"
"I have not decided yet." Sloane nodded with a sharp motion, and pulled his tattered clothes tight around his limbs to ward off the night cold. He sat with military precision, gazing with blank, empty eye sockets into the shadows that ringed their camp. He did not beg. He did not ask for mercy. He did not deny his acts or attempt to placate Eragon. He but sat and waited, armored by his perfect, stoic fortitude. His bravery impressed Eragon. The dark landscape around them seemed immense beyond reckoning to Eragon, and he felt as if the entire hidden expanse was converging upon him, a notion that heightened his anxiety over the choice that confronted him. "My verdict will shape the rest of his life," he thought. Abandoning for the moment the question of punishment, Eragon considered what he knew about Sloane. The butcher's overriding love for Katrina, obsessive, selfish, and generally unhealthy as it was, although it had once been something wholesome. His hate and fear of the spine which were the offspring of his grief for his late wife Ismira, who had fallen to her death among those cloud-rending peaks. His estrangement from the remaining branches of his family. His pride in his work. The stories Eragon had heard about Sloane's childhood, and Eragon's own knowledge of what it was like to live in Carvajal. Eragon took that collection of scattered, fragmented insights and turned them over in his mind, pondering their significance. Like the pieces of a puzzle, he tried to fit them together. He rarely succeeded, but he persisted, and gradually he traced a myriad of connections between the events and emotions of Sloane's life, and thereby he wove a tangled web, the patterns of which represented who Sloane was. Throwing the last line of his web, Eragon felt as if he finally comprehended the reasons for Sloane's behavior. Because of that, he empathized with Sloane. More than empathy, he felt he understood Sloane. That he had isolated the core elements of Sloane's personality, those things one could not remove without irrevocably changing the man. There occurred to him then three words in the ancient language that seemed to embody Sloane, and without thinking about it, Eragon whispered the words under his breath. The sound could not have reached Sloane, yet he stirred, his hands gripping his thighs, and his expression became one of unease. A cold tingle crawled down Eragon's left side, and goosebumps appeared on his arms and legs as he watched the butcher. He considered a number of different explanations for Sloane's reaction, each more elaborate than the last, but only one seemed plausible, and even it struck him as being unlikely. He whispered the trio of words again. As before, Sloane shifted in place, and Eragon heard him mutter, "Someone walking on my grave." Eragon released a shaky breath. It was difficult for him to believe, but his experiment left no room for doubt. He had, quite by accident, chanced upon Sloane's true name. The discovery left him rather bewildered. Knowing someone's true name was a weighty responsibility, for it granted you absolute power over that person. Because of the inherent risks, the elves rarely revealed their true names, and when they did, it was only to those whom they trusted without reservation. Aragorn had never learned anyone's true name before. He had always expected that if he did, it would be as a gift from someone he cared about a great deal. Gaining Sloane's true name without his consent was a turn of events Aragorn was unprepared for, and uncertain how to deal with. It dawned upon Aragorn that in order to guess Sloane's true name, he must understand the butcher better than he did himself, for he had not the slightest inkling what his own might be. The realization was an uncomfortable one. He suspected that, given the nature of his enemies, not knowing everything he could about himself might well prove fatal. He vowed, then, to devote more time to introspection and to uncovering his true name. "Perhaps Oromis and Gleda could tell me what it is," he thought. Whatever the doubts and confusion Sloane's true name roused within him, it gave Aragorn the beginning of an idea for how to deal with the butcher. Even once he had the basic concept, it still took him another 10 minutes to thrash out the rest of his plan and make sure that it would work in the manner he intended. Sloane tilted his head in Aragorn's direction as Aragorn rose and walked out of their camp into the starlit land beyond. "Where are you going?" asked Sloane. Aragorn remained silent. He wandered through the wilderness until he found a low, broad rock, covered with scabs of lichen, and with a bowl-like hollow in the middle. "A Durna riser," said he. Around the rock, countless minuscule droplets of water filtered up through the soil and coalesced into flawless silver tubes that arched over the edge of the rock and down into the hollow. When the water started to overflow and return to the earth, only to be again ensnared by his spell, Aragorn released the flow of magic. He waited until the surface of the water became perfectly still, so that it acted like a mirror, and he stood before what looked like a basin of stars. And then he said, "Draumur Kupa," and many other words besides, reciting a spell that would allow him to not only see, but speak with others at a distance. Oromis had taught him the variation on scrying 2 days before he and Saphira had left Ellesmira for Surda. The water went completely black, as if someone had extinguished the stars like candles. A moment or two later, an oval shape brightened in the middle of the water, and Aragorn beheld the interior of a large white tent, illuminated by the flameless light from a red Eristar, one of the elves' magical lanterns. Normally, Aragorn would be unable to scry a person or place he had not seen before. But the elves' seeing glass was enchanted to transmit an image of its surroundings to anyone who contacted the glass. Likewise, Aragorn's spell would project an image of himself and his surroundings onto the surface of the glass. The arrangement allowed strangers to contact each other from any location in the world, which was an invaluable ability in times of war. A tall elf with silver hair and battle-worn armor entered Aragorn's field of vision, and he recognized Lord Dathada, who advised Queen Islanzadi and was a friend of Arya's. If Dathada was surprised to see Aragorn, he did not show it. He inclined his head, touched the first 2 fingers of his right hand to his lips, and said in his lilting voice, "Atra sterni onotheldwin, Aragorn Shurtugal." Mentally making the shift to conversing in the ancient language, Aragorn duplicated the gesture with his fingers and replied, "Atra du everinja onu varda, Dathadar vodar." Continuing in his native tongue, Dathadar said, "I am glad to know you are well, Shadeslayer. Arya Drotningu informed us of your mission some days ago, and we have been much concerned on your behalf and Saphira's. I trust nothing has gone amiss?"
"No,
but I encountered an unforeseen problem, and if I may, I would consult with Queen Islanzadi and seek her wisdom in this matter.
Daedhera's cat-like eyes drifted nearly shut, becoming two angled slashes that gave him a fierce and unreadable expression.
I know you would not ask this unless it is important, Eragon Vodar. But beware. A drawn bow may just as easily snap and injure the archer as it may send the arrow flying. If it so please you, wait, and I shall inquire after the queen.
I shall wait. Your assistance is most welcome, Daedhera Vodar. As the elf turned away from the seeing glass, Eragon grimaced. He disliked the elves' formality, but most of all he hated trying to interpret their enigmatic statements. Was he warning me that scheming and plotting around the queen is a dangerous pastime? Or that Islanzadi is a drawn bow about to snap? Or did he mean something else entirely? At least I'm able to contact the elves, thought Eragon. The elves' wards prevented anything from entering Duweldenvarden by magical means, including the far sight of scrying. So long as elves remained in their cities, one could communicate with them only by sending messengers into their forest. But now that the elves were on the move and had left the shade of their black-needled pine trees, their great spells no longer protected them, and it was possible to use devices such as the seeing glass. Eragon became increasingly anxious as first 1 minute and then another trickled past.
Come on, he murmured.
He quickly glanced around to make sure that no person or beast was creeping up on him while he gazed into the pool of water. With a sound akin to ripping cloth, the entrance flap to the tent flew open as Queen Islanzadi thrust it aside and stormed toward the seeing glass. She wore a bright corselet of golden scale armor, augmented with mail and greaves, and a beautifully decorated helm, set with opals and other precious gemstones that held back her flowing black tresses. A red cape trimmed with white billowed from her shoulders. It reminded Eragon of a looming storm front. In her left hand, Islanzadi wielded a naked sword. Her right hand was empty, but it appeared gloved in crimson, and after a moment Eragon realized that dripping blood coated her fingers and wrist. Islanzadi's slanting eyebrows narrowed as she looked upon Eragon. With that expression, she bore a striking resemblance to Arya, although her stature and bearing were even more impressive than her daughter's. She was beautiful and terrible, like a frightful goddess of war. Eragon touched his lips with his fingers, then twisted his right hand over his chest in the elves' gesture of loyalty and respect, and recited the opening line of their traditional greeting, speaking first, as was proper when addressing one of higher rank. Islanzadi made the expected response, and in an attempt to please her and demonstrate his knowledge of their customs, Eragon concluded with the optional third line of the salutation, "And may peace live in your heart." The ferocity of Islanzadi's pose diminished somewhat, and a faint smile touched her lips, as if to acknowledge his maneuver.
"And yours as well, Shadeslayer."
Her low, rich voice contained hints of rustling pine needles and gurgling brooks and music played on reed pipes. Sheathing her sword, she moved across the tent to the folding table and stood at an angle to Eragon as she washed the blood off her skin with water from a pitcher.
"Peace is difficult to come by these days, I fear."
"The fighting is heavy, Your Majesty?"
"It will be soon. My people are massing along the western edge of Duweldenvarden, where we may prepare to kill and be killed while we are close to the trees we love so much. We are a scattered race, and do not march in rank and file like others do, on account of the damage it inflicts upon the land, and so it takes time for us to assemble from the distant reaches of the forest."
"I understand. Only..."
He searched for a way to ask his question without being rude, If the fighting has not started yet, I cannot help but wonder why your hand is dyed with gore.
Shaking water droplets off her fingers, Islanzadi lifted her perfect gold-brown forearm for Aragorn's inspection, and he realized that she had been the model for the sculpture of two intertwined arms that stood in the entryway to his treehouse in Ellesmere.
Dyed no more. The only stain blood leaves on a person is on her soul, not her body. I said the fighting would escalate in the near future, not that we had yet to start.
She pulled the sleeve of her corselet and the tunic underneath back down to her wrist. From the jeweled belt wrapped around her slim waist, she removed a gauntlet stitched with silver thread and worked her hand into it.
We have been observing the city of Siunon, for we intend to attack there first. 2 days ago, our rangers spotted teams of men and mules traveling from Siunon into Duweldenwaarden. We thought they wished to collect timber from the edge of the forest, as is often done. 'Tis a practice we tolerate, for the humans must have wood, and the trees within the fringe are young and nearly beyond our influence, and we have not wanted to expose ourselves before. The teams did not stop at the fringe, however. They burrowed far into Duweldenwaarden, following game trails they were obviously familiar with. They were searching for the tallest, thickest trees, trees as old as Alagaesia itself, trees that were already ancient and fully grown when the dwarves discovered Fardendur. When they found them, they began to saw them down. Her voice rippled with rage. From their remarks, we learned why they were here. Galbatorix wanted the largest trees he could acquire to replace the siege engines and battering rams he lost during the battle on the Burning Plains. If their motive had been pure and honest, we might have forgiven the loss of one monarch of our forest, maybe even two, but not 28.
A chill crept through Aragorn.
"What did you do?" he asked, although he already suspected the answer.
Islanzadi lifted her chin, and her face grew hard.
"I was present with two of our rangers. Together we corrected the human's mistake. In the past, the people of Siunon knew better than to intrude upon our lands. Today we reminded them why that was so."
Without seeming to notice, she rubbed her right hand as if it pained her, and she gazed past the seeing glass, looking at some vision of her own.
"You have learned what it is like, Aragorn Finearel, to touch the life force of the plants and animals around you. Imagine how you would cherish them if you had possessed that ability for centuries. We give of ourselves to sustain Duweldenwaarden, and the forest is an extension of our bodies and minds. Any hurt it suffers is our hurt as well. We are a slow people to rouse, but once roused we are like the dragons. We go mad with anger. It has been over 100 years since I, or most any elf, shed blood in battle. The world has forgotten what we are capable of. Our strength may have declined since the rider's fall, but we shall still give a full reckoning of ourselves. To our enemies it will seem as if even the elements have turned against them. We are an elder race, and our skill and knowledge far exceed that of mortal men. Let Galbatorix and his allies beware, for we elves are about to forsake our forest, and we shall return in triumph, or never again."
Aragorn shivered. Even during his confrontations with Durza, he had never encountered such implacable determination and ruthlessness.
"It's not human," he thought, then laughed mockingly to himself.
"Of course not, and I would do well to remember that. However much we may look alike, and in my case nigh on identical, we are not the same.
If you take Siunon, he said, how will you control the people there? They may hate the Empire more than death itself, but I doubt they will trust you, if only because they are humans and you are elves.
Islanzadi waved a hand. That is unimportant. Once we are within the city walls, we have ways to ensure that no one will oppose us. This is not the first time we have fought your kind.
She removed her helm then, and her hair fell forward and framed her face between raven locks.
I was not pleased to hear of your raid on Helgrind. But I take it the assault is already over and was successful?
Yes, Your Majesty.
Then my objections are for naught. I warn you, however, Eragon Shurtagal, do not imperil yourself on such needlessly dangerous ventures. It is a cruel thing, I must say, but true nevertheless, and it is this. Your life is more important than your cousin's happiness.
I swore an oath to Roran that I would help him.
Then you swore recklessly, without considering the consequences.
Would you have me abandon those I care about? If I did that, I would become a man to despise and distrust. An ill-formed vehicle for the hopes of the people who believe I will, somehow, bring low Galbatorix. And also, while Katrina was Galbatorix's hostage, Roran was vulnerable to his manipulation.
The Queen lifted one dagger-sharp eyebrow.
A vulnerability that you could have prevented Galbatorix from exploiting by tutoring Roran in certain oaths in this, the language of magic.
I do not counsel you to cast away your friends or family. That would be folly indeed. But keep you firmly in mind what is at stake. The entirety of Alagasia. If we fail now, then Galbatorix's tyranny will extend over all the races, and his reign shall have no conceivable end. You are the tip of the spear that is our effort, and if the tip should break and be lost, then our spear shall bounce off the armor of our foe, and we too shall be lost.
Folds of lichen cracked underneath Aragorn's fingers as he gripped the edge of the rock basin, and suppressed the urge to make an impertinent remark about how any well-equipped warrior ought to have a sword or another weapon to rely upon, besides a spear. He was frustrated by the direction the conversation had taken, and eager to change the topic as quickly as he could. He had not contacted the Queen so she could berate him as if he were a mere child. Nevertheless, allowing his impatience to dictate his actions would do nothing to further his cause. So he remained calm, and replied, "Please believe me, Your Majesty, I take your concerns very, very seriously. I can only say that if I hadn't helped Roran, I would have been as miserable as he, and more so if he attempted to rescue Katrina by himself and died as a result. In either case, I would have been too upset to be of any use to you or anyone. Cannot we at least agree to differ on the subject? Neither of us shall convince the other."
"Very well," said Islanzadi. "We shall lay the matter to rest, for the present. But do not think you have escaped a proper investigation of your decision, Aragorn Dragon Rider. It seems to me you display a frivolous attitude toward your larger responsibilities, and that is a serious matter. I shall discuss it with Oromis. He will decide what is to be done about you. Now tell me, why did you seek this audience?"
Aragorn clenched his teeth several times before he could bring himself to, in a civil tone, explain the day's events, the reasons for his actions in regard to Sloane, and the punishment he envisioned for the butcher. When he finished, Islanzadi whirled around and paced the circumference of the tent, her movements as lithe as a cat's, then stopped and said,
"You chose to stay behind in the middle of the Empire to save the life of a murderer and a traitor. You are alone with this man, on foot, without supplies or weapons, save for magic, and your enemies are close behind. I see my earlier admonishments were more than justified. You..."
Your Majesty, if you must be angry with me, be angry with me later. I want to resolve this quickly so I can get some rest before dawn. I have many miles to cover tomorrow.
The Queen nodded. Your survival is all that matters. I shall be furious after we are done speaking. As for your request, such a thing is unprecedented in our history. If I had been in your place, I would have killed Sloane and rid myself of the problem then and there.
I know you would have. I once watched Arya slay a Jurfalcon who was injured, for she said its death was inevitable, and by killing it, she saved the bird hours of suffering. Perhaps I should have done the same with Sloane, but I couldn't. I think it would have been a choice I would have regretted for the rest of my life, or worse, one that would have made it easier for me to kill in the future.
Islanzadi sighed, and suddenly she appeared tired. Aragorn reminded himself that she, too, had been fighting that day.
Oromis may have been your proper teacher, but you have proved yourself Brom's heir, not Oromis's. Brom is the only other person who managed to entangle himself in as many predicaments as you. Like him, you seem compelled to find the deepest patch of quicksand and then dive into it.
Aragorn hid a smile, pleased by the comparison.
What of Sloane? He asked. His fate rests with you now.
Slowly Islanzadi sat upon a stool next to the folding table, placed her hands in her lap, and gazed to one side of the seeing glass. Her countenance became one of enigmatic observation, a beautiful mask that concealed her thoughts and feelings, and one that Aragorn could not penetrate, no matter how hard he strove. When she spoke, she said,
"As you have seen fit to save this man's life at no little trouble and effort on your own part, I cannot refuse your request and thereby render your sacrifice meaningless. If Sloane survives the ordeal you have set before him, then Gilderian the Wise shall allow him to pass, and Sloane shall have a room and a bed and food to eat. More I cannot promise, for what happens afterward will depend on Sloane himself. But if the conditions you named are met, then yes, we shall light his darkness."
"Thank you, Your Majesty. You are most generous."
"No, not generous. This war does not allow me to be generous, only practical. Go and do what you must. And be you careful, Aragorn Shadeslayer."
"Your Majesty," he bowed, "if I may ask one last favor, would you please refrain from telling Arya, Nasawada, or any of the Varden of my current situation? I don't want them to worry about me any longer than they have to, and they'll learn of it soon enough from Saphira."
"I shall consider your request."
Aragorn waited. But when she remained silent and it became clear she had no intention of announcing her decision, he bowed a second time and again said,
"Thank you."
The glowing image on the surface of the water flickered and then vanished into darkness as Aragorn ended the spell he had used to create it. He leaned back on his heels and gazed up at the multitude of stars, allowing his eyes to readjust to the faint, glimmering light they provided. Then he left the crumbling rock with the pool of water and retraced his path across the grass and scrub to the camp, where Sloane still sat upright, rigid as cast iron. Aragorn struck a pebble with his foot and the resulting noise revealed his presence to Sloane, who snapped his head around, quick as a bird.
"Have you made up your mind?" demanded Sloane.
"I have," said Aragorn.
He stopped and squatted in front of the butcher, steadying himself with one hand on the ground.
"Hear me well, for I don't intend to repeat myself. You did what you did because of your love for Katrina, or so you say. Whether you admit it or not, I believe you also had other, baser motives in wanting to separate her from Roran. Anger, hate, vindictiveness, and your own hurt."
Sloane's lips hardened into thin white lines.
"You wrong me."
"No, I don't think so.
since my conscience prevents me from killing you, your punishment is to be the most terrible I could invent short of death. I'm convinced that what you said before is true, that Katrina is more important to you than anything else. Therefore, your punishment is this. You shall not see, touch, or talk with your daughter again, even unto your dying day. And you shall live with the knowledge that she is with Roran, and they are happy together, without you.
Sloane inhaled through his clenched teeth.
That is your punishment? Ha! You cannot enforce it! You have no prison to put me in!
I'm not finished. I will enforce it by having you swear oaths in the elves' tongue, in the language of truth and magic, to abide by the terms of your sentence.
You can't force me to give my word, Sloane growled. Not even if you torture me.
I can, and I won't torture you. Furthermore, I will lay upon you a compulsion to travel northward until you reach the elf city of Ellesmere, which stands deep in the heart of Duweldenvarden. You can try to resist the urge if you want, but no matter how long you fight it, the spell will irritate you like an unscratched itch until you obey its demands and travel to the elves' realm.
Don't you have the guts to kill me yourself? Asked Sloane. You're too much of a coward to put a blade to my neck, so you'll make me wander the wilderness blind and lost until the weather or the beasts do me in.
He spat to the left of Aragorn.
You're nothing but the yellow-bellied offspring of a canker-ridden bunter. You're a bastard, you are, and an unlicked cub, a dung-splattered, tallow-faced rock-gnasher, a puking villain and a noxious toad, the runty, mewling spawn of a greasy sow. I wouldn't give you my last crust if you were starving, or a drop of water if you were burning, or a beggar's grave if you were dead. You have pus for marrow and fungus for brains, and you're a scug-backed cheek-biter.
There was, Aragorn thought, something rather obscenely impressive about Sloane swearing, although his admiration did not prevent him from wanting to strangle the butcher, or at least respond in kind. What stayed his desire for retaliation, however, was his suspicion that Sloane was deliberately trying to infuriate him enough to strike down the older man, and thus give him a quick and undeserved end. Aragorn said, "Bastard, I may be, but not a murderer." Sloane drew a sharp breath. Before he could resume his torrent of abuse, Aragorn added, "Wherever you go, you shall not want for food, nor will wild animals attack you. I will place certain enchantments around you that will keep men and beasts from troubling you, and will cause animals to bring you sustenance when you need it."
"You can't do this,"
whispered Sloane. Even in the starlight, Aragorn could see the last remnants of colour drain from his skin, leaving him bone white.
"You don't have the means. You don't have the right."
"I am a dragon rider. I have as much right as any king or queen." Then Aragorn, who had no interest in continuing to chastise Sloane, uttered the butcher's true name loud enough for him to hear. An expression of horror and revelation crawled across Sloane's face, and he threw his arms up before him and howled as if he had been stabbed. His cry was raw and jagged and desolate, the scream of a man condemned by his own nature to a fate he could not escape. He fell forward onto the palms of his hands and remained in that position and began to sob, his face obscured by shocks of hair. Aragorn watched, transfixed by Sloane's reaction.
"Does learning your true name affect everyone like this? Would this happen to me as well?"
Hardening his heart to Sloane's misery, Aragorn set about doing what he said he would. He repeated Sloane's true name, and word by word schooled the butcher in the ancient language oaths that would ensure Sloane never met or contacted Katrina again. Sloane resisted with much weeping and wailing and grinding of his teeth, but no matter how vigorously he struggled, he had no choice but to obey whenever Aragorn invoked his true name. And when they finished with the oaths, Aragorn cast the five spells that would drive Sloane toward Ellesmere, would protect him from unprovoked violence, and would entice the birds and the beasts and the fish that dwelled in the rivers and lakes to feed him. Aragorn fashioned the spells so they would derive their energy from Sloane and not himself. Midnight was a fading memory by the time Aragorn completed the final incantation. Drunk with weariness, he leaned against the hawthorn staff. Sloane lay curled at his feet.
"Finished," said Aragorn.
A garbled moan drifted up from the figure below. It sounded as if Sloane were attempting to say something. Frowning, Aragorn knelt beside him. Sloane's cheeks were red and bloody where he had scraped them with his fingers. His nose ran, and tears dripped from the corner of his left eye socket, which was the less mutilated of the two. Pity and guilt welled up inside of Aragorn. It gave him no pleasure to see Sloane reduced to such a low state. He was a broken man, stripped of everything he valued in life, including his self-delusions. And Aragorn was the one who had broken him. The accomplishment left Aragorn feeling soiled, as if he had done something shameful. "It was necessary," he thought, "but no one should have to do what I did." Another moan emanated from Sloane, and then he said,
"Only a piece of rope. I didn't mean to. Is Mira? No, no, please, no."
The butcher's rambling subsided, and in the intervening silence, Aragorn placed his hand on Sloane's upper arm. Sloane stiffened at the contact.
"Aragorn," he whispered, "Aragorn, I am blind, and you send me to walk the land alone. I am forsaken and forsworn. I know who I am, and I cannot bear it. Help me, kill me, free me of this agony."
On an impulse, Aragorn pressed the hawthorn rod into Sloane's right hand and said, "Take my staff. Let it guide you on your journey."
"Kill me."
"No." A cracked shout burst from Sloane's throat, and he thrashed from side to side and pounded the earth with his fists.
"Cruel, cruel you are."
His meager strength depleted, he curled into an even tighter ball, panting and whimpering. Bending over him, Aragorn placed his mouth close to Sloane's ear and whispered,
"I am not without mercy, so I give you this hope. If you reach Ellesmere, you will find a home waiting for you. The elves will care for you and allow you to do whatever you want for the rest of your life, with one exception. Once you enter Dueldenvarden, you cannot leave. Sloane, listen to me. When I was among the elves, I learned that a person's true name often changes as they age. Do you understand what that means? Who you are is not fixed for all of eternity. A man could forge himself anew if he so wanted."
Sloane made no reply. Aragorn left the staff next to Sloane and crossed to the other side of the camp and stretched out his full length on the ground. His eyes already closed, he mumbled a spell that would rouse him before dawn, and then allowed himself to drift into the soothing embrace of his waking rest. The grey heath was cold, dark and inhospitable, when a low buzz sounded inside Aragorn's head.
"Letter,"
he said, and the buzzing ceased. Groaning as he stretched sore muscles, he got to his feet and lifted his arms over his head, shaking them to get the blood flowing. His back felt so bruised he hoped it would be a long while before he had to swing a weapon again. He lowered his arms and then looked for Sloane. The butcher was gone. Aragorn smiled as he saw a set of tracks accompanied by the round imprint of the staff leading away from the camp. The trail was confused and meandering, and yet its general direction was northward, toward the great forest of the elves.
"I want him to succeed," Aragorn thought with mild surprise. "I want him to succeed, because it will mean we may all have a chance to redeem ourselves from our mistakes. And if Sloane can mend the flaws in his character, and come to terms with the evil he wrought, he will find his plight is not so bleak as he believes." For Aragorn had not told Sloane that if the butcher demonstrated that he truly regretted his crimes, reformed his ways and lived as a better person, Queen Islandzadi would have her spellweavers restore his vision. However, it was a reward Sloane had to earn without knowing about its existence, else he might seek to trick the elves into bestowing it prematurely. Aragorn stared at the footprints for a long while, then lifted his gaze to the horizon and said, "Good luck." Tired, but also content, he turned his back on Sloane's trail and began to run across the grey heath. To the southwest, he knew there stood the ancient sandstone formations where Brom lay encased in his diamond tomb. He longed to divert his path and to go pay his respects, but dared not. For if Galbatorix had discovered the site, he would send his agents there to look for Aragorn. "I'll return," he said. "I promise you, Brom. Some day I'll return." He sped onward. The Trial of the Long Knives.
"But we are your people!"
Fadawar, a tall, high-nosed, black-skinned man, spoke with the same heavy emphasis and altered vowels Nasawada remembered hearing during her childhood in Farthendur, when emissaries from her father's tribe would arrive, and she would sit on Arjahad's lap and doze while they talked and smoked cardus weed. Nasawada gazed up at Fadawar, and wished she were 6 inches taller, so that she could look the warlord and his 4 retainers straight in the eyes. Still, she was accustomed to men looming over her. She found it rather more disconcerting to be among a group of people who were as dark as she was. It was a novel experience not to be the object of people's curious stares and whispered comments. She was standing in front of the carved chair where she held her audiences, one of the only solid chairs the Varden had brought with them on their campaign, inside her red command pavilion. The sun was close to setting, and its rays filtered through the right side of the pavilion as through stained glass, and gave the contents a ruddy glow. A long, low table, covered with scattered reports and maps, occupied one half of the pavilion. Just outside the entrance to the large tent, she knew the 6 members of her personal guard, 2 humans, 2 dwarves and 2 Urgals, were waiting with drawn weapons, ready to attack if they received the slightest indication she was in peril. Jormungandr, her oldest and most trusted commander, had saddled her with guards since the day Arjahad died. But never so many for so long. However, the day after the battle on the Burning Plains, Jormungandr expressed his deep and abiding concern for her safety. A concern, he said, that often kept him up nights with a burning stomach. As an assassin had tried to kill her in Aberon, and Murtagh had actually accomplished the deed in regard to King Hrothgar less than a week past, it was Jormungandr's opinion that Nasawada ought to create a force dedicated to her own defense. She had objected that such a measure would be an overreaction, but had been unable to convince Jormungandr. He had threatened to abdicate his post if she refused to adopt what he considered to be proper precautions. Eventually, she acceded, only to spend the next hour haggling over how many guards she was to have. He had wanted 12 or more at all times. She wanted 4 or fewer. They settled on 6, which still struck Nasawada as too many. She worried about appearing afraid, or worse, as if she were attempting to intimidate those she met. Again, her protestations had failed to sway Jormungandr. When she accused him of being a stubborn old worrywart, he laughed and said,
"Better a stubborn old worrywart than a foolhardy youngling dead before his time."
As the members of her guard changed every 6 hours, the total number of warriors assigned to protect Nasawada was 34, including the 10 additional warriors who remained in readiness to replace their comrades in case of sickness, injury, or death. It was Nasawada who had insisted upon recruiting the force from each of the 3 mortal races arrayed against Galbatorix. By doing so, she hoped to foster greater solidarity among them, as well as to convey that she represented the interests of all the races under her command, not just the humans. She would have included the elves as well, but at the moment, Arya was the only elf who fought alongside the Varden and their allies, and the 12 spellcasters Islanzadi had sent to protect Aragorn had yet to arrive. To Nasawada's disappointment, her human and dwarf guards had been hostile to the Urghuls they served with, a reaction she anticipated, but had been unable to avert or mitigate. It would, she knew, take more than one shared battle to ease the tensions between races that had fought and hated each other for more generations than she cared to count. Still, she viewed it as encouraging that the warriors chose to name their corps the Nighthawks, for the title was a play upon both her colouring and the fact that the Urghuls invariably referred to her as Lady Nightstalker. Although she would never admit it to Jormungandr, Nasawada had quickly come to appreciate the increased sense of security her guards provided. In addition to being masters of their chosen weapons, whether they were the human swords, the dwarves' axes, or the Urghuls' eccentric collection of instruments, many of the warriors were skilled spellweavers, and they had all sworn their undying loyalty to her in the ancient language. Since the day the Nighthawks first assumed their duties, they had not left Nasawada alone with another person, save for Ferica, her handmaid. That was until now. Nasawada had sent them out of the pavilion because she knew her meeting with Fadawar might lead to the type of bloodshed the Nighthawk's sense of duty would require them to prevent. Even so, she was not entirely defenseless. She had a dagger hidden in the folds of her dress, and an even smaller knife in the bodice of her undergarments, and the prescient witch-child Elva was standing just behind the curtain that backed Nasawada's chair, ready to intercede if need be. Fadawar tapped his 4-foot-long scepter against the ground. The chaste rod was made of solid gold, as was his fantastic array of jewellery. Gold bangles covered his forearms, a breastplate of hammered gold armoured his chest. Long, thick chains of gold hung around his neck. Embossed discs of white gold stretched the lobes of his ears, and upon the top of his head rested a resplendent gold crown of such huge proportions, Nasawada wondered how Fadawar's neck could support the weight without buckling, and how such a monumental piece of architecture remained fixed in place. It seemed one would have to bolt the edifice, which was at least 2.5 feet tall, to its bony bedrock in order to keep it from toppling over. Fadawar's men were garbed in the same fashion, although less opulently. The gold they wore served to proclaim not only their wealth, but also the status and deeds of each individual, and the skill of their tribe's far-famed craftsmen. As either nomads or city-dwellers, the dark-skinned peoples of Alagasia had long been renowned for the quality of their jewellery, which at its best rivaled that of the dwarves. Nasawada owned several pieces of her own, but she had chosen not to wear them. Her poor raiment could not compete with Fadawar's splendour. Also, she believed it would not be wise to affiliate herself with any one group, no matter how rich or influential, when she had to deal with and speak for all the differing factions of the Varden. If she displayed partiality toward one or another, her ability to control the whole lot of them would diminish. Which was the basis of her argument with Fadawar. Fadawar again jabbed his scepter into the ground.
"Blood is the most important thing. First come your responsibilities to your family, then to your tribe, then to your warlord, then to the gods above and below, and only then to your king and to your nation, if you have them. That is how Unulukuna intended men to live, and that is how we should live, if we want to be happy. Are you brave enough to spit on the shoes of the Old One? If a man does not help his family, whom can he depend upon to help him? Friends are fickle, but family is forever.
You ask me, said Nasawada, to give positions of power to your fellow kinsmen, because you are my mother's cousin, and because my father was born among you. This I would be happy to do if your kinsmen could fulfill those positions better than anyone else in the Varden. But nothing you have said thus far has convinced me that is so. And before you squander more of your guilt-tongued eloquence, you should know that appeals based upon our shared blood are meaningless to me. I would give your request greater consideration if ever you had done more to support my father than send trinkets and empty promises to Farthen Dur. Only now that victory and influence are mine have you made yourself known to me. Well, my parents are dead, and I say I have no family but myself. You are my people, yes, but nothing more.
Fadawa narrowed his eyes and lifted his chin and said, A woman's pride is always without sense. You shall fail without our support.
He had switched to his native language, which forced Nasawada to respond in kind. She hated him for it. Her halting speech and uncertain tones exposed her unfamiliarity with her birth tongue, emphasizing that she had not grown up in their tribe, but was an outsider. The ploy undermined her authority.
I always welcome new allies, she said. However, I cannot indulge in favoritism, nor should you have need of it. Your tribes are strong and well-gifted. They should be able to rise quickly through the ranks of the Varden without having to rely upon the charity of others. Are you starving dogs to sit whining at my table, or are you men who can feed themselves? If you can, then I look forward to working with you, to better the Varden's lot, and to defeat Galvatorix.
Bah! Exclaimed Fadawa. Your offer is as false as you are. We shall not do servants' work. We are the chosen ones. You insult us, you do. You stand there and you smile, but your heart is full of scorpion's poison.
Stifling her anger, Nasawada attempted to calm the warlord.
It was not my intent to cause offense. I was only trying to explain my position. I have no enmity for the wandering tribes, nor have I any special love for them. Is that such a bad thing?
It is worse than bad. It is bald-faced treachery. Your father made certain requests of us, based upon our relation, and now you ignore our service and turn us away like empty-handed beggars.
A sense of resignation overwhelmed Nasawada.
So Elva was right. It is inevitable, she thought. A thrill of fear and excitement coursed through her. If it must be, then I have no reason to maintain this charade.
Allowing her voice to ring forth, she said,
Requests that you did not honor half the time.
We did.
You did not. And even if you were telling the truth, the Varden's position is too precarious for me to give you something for nothing. You ask for favors, yet tell me, what do you offer in return? Will you help fund the Varden with your gold and jewels?
Not directly, but...
Will you give me the use of your craftsmen free of charge?
We could not.
How, then, do you intend to earn these boons? You cannot pay with warriors. Your men already fight for me, whether in the Varden or in King Orin's army. Be content with what you have, warlord, and do not seek more than is rightfully yours.
You twist the truth to suit your own selfish goals. I seek what is rightfully ours. That is why I am here. You talk and you talk, yet your words are meaningless, for by your actions you have betrayed us.
The bangles on his arms clattered together as he gestured, as if before an